Part 7. Lord of Eternity. Egypt, Section 2. Chapter 40. Are there any secrets left in Egypt? During the early evening of the 26th of November 1922, the British archaeologist Howard Carter, together with his sponsor Lord Carnarvon, entered the tomb of a youthful pharaoh of the 18th dynasty who had ruled Egypt from 1352 to 1343 BC, the name of that pharaoh, which has since resounded around the world, was Tutankhamun. Two nights later, on the 28th of November, the tomb's treasury was breached. It was filled with a huge golden shrine and gave access to another chamber beyond. Rather unusually, this chamber, although heaped with a dazzling array of precious and beautiful artifacts, had no door. Its entrance was watched over by an extraordinarily lifelike effigy of the jackal-headed mortuary god Anubis. With his ears erect, the god crouched dog-like, forepaws stretched out, on the lid of a gilded wooden casket, perhaps 4 feet long, 3 feet high, and 2 feet wide. The Egyptian Museum, Cairo, December 1993. Still perched astride his casket, but now locked away in a dusty glass display case, Anubis held my attention for a long, quiet moment. His effigy had been carved out of stuccoed wood, entirely covered with black resin, and then painstakingly inlaid with gold, alabaster, calcite, obsidian, and silver, materials used to particular effect in the eyes, which glittered watchfully, with an unsettling sense of fierce and focused intelligence. At the same time, his finely etched ribs and lithe musculature gave off an aura of understated strength, energy, and grace. Captured by the force field of this occult and powerful presence, I was vividly reminded of the universal myths of precession I had been studying during the past year. Canine figures moved back and forth among these myths in a manner which at times had seemed almost plotted in the literary sense. I had begun to wonder whether the symbolism of dogs, wolves, jackals, and so on might have been deliberately employed by the long-dead mythmakers to guide initiates through a maze of clues to secret reservoirs of lost scientific knowledge. Amongst these reservoirs, I suspected, was the myth of Osiris. Much more than a myth, it had been dramatized and performed each year in ancient Egypt in the form of a mystery play, a plotted literary artifact passed down as a treasured tradition since prehistoric times. This tradition, as we saw in Part 5, contained values for the rate of precessional motion that were so accurate and so consistent it was extremely difficult to attribute them to chance. Nor did it seem likely to be an accident that the jackal god had been assigned a role center stage in the drama, serving as the spirit guide of Osiris on his journey through the underworld. It was tempting, too, to wonder whether there was any significance in the fact that in ancient times, Anubis had been referred to by Egyptian priests as the guardian of the secret and sacred writings. Under the grooved edge of the gilded casket on which his effigy now crouched was found an inscription, "Initiated into the secrets." Alternative translations of the same hieroglyphic text rendered it variously as "he who is upon the secrets" and as "guardian of the secrets." But were there any secrets left in Egypt? After more than a century of intensive archaeological investigations, could the sands of this antique land yield any further surprises? Bhowal's Stars and West's Stones. In 1993, there was an astonishing new discovery which suggested that there was much still to learn about ancient Egypt. The discoverer, moreover, was not some astigmatic archaeologist sieving his way through the dust of ages, but an outsider to the field, Robert Bhowal, a Belgian construction engineer with a flair for astronomy, who observed a correlation in the sky that the experts had missed in their fixation with the ground at their feet. What Bhowal saw was this: as the three belt stars of the Orion constellation crossed the meridian at Giza, they lay in a not quite straight line high in the southern heavens. The lower two stars, Al-Nitak and Al-Nilam formed a perfect diagonal, but the third star, Mintaka, appeared to be offset to the observer's left, that is, towards the east. Curiously enough, as we saw in Chapter 36, this was exactly the site plan of the three enigmatic pyramids of the Giza Plateau. Bovall realized that an aerial view of the Giza necropolis would show the Great Pyramid of Khufu occupying the position of Al-Nitak, and the second pyramid of Khafre occupying the position of Al-Nilam, while the third pyramid of Menkaure was offset to the east of the diagonal formed by the other two, thus completing what seemed at first to be a vast diagram of the stars. Was this indeed what the Giza pyramids represented? I knew that Bovall's later work, which had been wholeheartedly endorsed by mathematicians and astronomers, had borne out his inspired hunch. His evidence, reviewed fully in Chapter 49, showed that the three pyramids were an unbelievably precise terrestrial map of the three stars of Orion's belt, accurately reflecting the angles between each of them, and even, by means of their respective sizes, providing some indication of their individual magnitudes. Moreover, this map extended outwards to the north and south to encompass several other structures on the Giza Plateau, once again with faultless precision. However, the real surprise revealed by Bovall's astronomical calculations was this. Despite the fact that some aspects of the Great Pyramid did relate astronomically to the Pyramid Age, the Giza monuments as a whole were so arranged as to provide a picture of the skies, which alter their appearance down the ages as a result of precession of the equinoxes, not as they had looked in the 4th dynasty, around 2500 BC, but as they had looked, and only as they had looked, around the year 10,450 BC. I had come to Egypt to go over the Giza site with Robert Bovall and to question him about his star correlation theory. In addition, I wanted to canvass his views on what sort of human society, if any, could have had the technological know-how such a very long while ago to measure accurately the altitudes of the stars and to devise a plan as mathematical and ambitious as that of the Giza necropolis. I had also come to meet another researcher who had challenged the orthodox chronology of ancient Egypt with a well-founded claim to have found hard evidence of a high civilization in the Nile Valley in 10,000 BC or earlier. Like Bovall's astronomical data, the evidence had always been available but had failed to attract the attention of established Egyptologists. The man responsible for bringing it before the public now was the American scholar John Anthony West, who argued that the specialists had missed it, not because they had failed to find it, but because they had found it and failed to interpret it properly. West's evidence focused on certain key structures, notably the Great Sphinx and the Bali Temple at Giza, and much farther south, the mysterious Osirion at Abydos. He argued that these desert monuments showed many scientifically unmistakable signs of having been weathered by water, an erosive agent they could only have been exposed to in sufficient quantities during the damp pluvial period that accompanied the end of the last ice age around the 11th millennium BC. The implication of this peculiar and extremely distinctive pattern of precipitation-induced weathering was that the Osirion, the Sphinx, and other associated structures were built before 10,000 BC. A British investigative journalist summed up the effect. West is really an academic's worst nightmare, because here comes somebody way out of left field with a thoroughly well thought out, well presented, coherently described theory, full of data they can't refute, and it pulls the rug out from beneath their feet. So how do they deal with it? They ignore it. They hope it'll go away. And it won't go away. The reason the new theory would not under any circumstances go away, despite its rejection by droves of competent Egyptologists, was that it had won widespread support from another scientific branch of scholarship, geology. Dr. Robert Schock, a professor of geology at Boston University, had played a prominent role in validating West's estimates concerning the true age of the Sphinx and his views had been endorsed by almost 300 of his peers at the 1992 annual convention of the Geological Society of America. Since then, most often out of the public eye, an acrimonious dispute had begun to smoulder between the geologists and the Egyptologists. And though very few people other than John West were prepared to say as much, what was at stake in this dispute was a complete upheaval in accepted views about the evolution of human civilization. According to West, we are told that the evolution of human civilization is a linear process, that it goes from stupid cavemen to smart old us with our hydrogen bombs and striped toothpaste. But the proof that the Sphinx is many, many thousands of years older than the archaeologists think it is, that it preceded by many thousands of years even dynastic Egypt, means that there must have been, at some distant point in history, a high and sophisticated civilization, just as all the legends affirm. My own travels and research during the preceding 4 years had opened my eyes to the electrifying possibility that those legends could be true, and this was why I had come back to Egypt to meet West and Boval. I was struck by the way in which their hitherto disparate lines of inquiry had converged so convincingly on what appeared to be the astronomical and geological fingerprints of a lost civilization, one that might or might not have originated in the Nile Valley, but that seemed to have had a presence here as far back as the 11th millennium BC. The Way of the Jackal. Anubis, guardian of the secrets, god of the funerary chamber, jackal-headed opener of the ways of the dead, guide and companion to Osiris. It was around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, closing time at the Cairo Museum, when Santha pronounced herself satisfied with her photographs of the sinister black effigy. Down below us, guards were whistling and clapping their hands as they sought to herd the last few sightseers out of the halls, but up on the second floor of the 100-year-old building, where ancient Anubis crouched in his millennial watchfulness, all was quiet, all was still. We left the somber museum and walked down into the sunlight, still bathing Cairo's bustling Tahrir Square. Anubis, I reflected, had shared his duties as spirit guide and guardian of the secret writings with another god, whose type and symbol had also been the jackal, and whose name, Upuaut, literally meant opener of the ways. Both these canine deities had been linked since time immemorial with the ancient town of Abydos in Upper Egypt, the original god of which, Kenti Amentiu, the strangely named foremost of the Westerners, had also been represented as a member of the dog family, usually lying recumbent on a black standard. Was there any significance in the repeated recurrence at Abydos of all this mythical and symbolic doggishness, with its promise of high secrets waiting to unfold? It seemed worthwhile trying to find out, since the extensive ruins there included the structure known as the Osirion, which West's geological research had indicated might be far older than the archaeologists thought. Besides, I had already arranged to meet West in a few days in the upper Egyptian town of Luxor, less than 200 kilometers south of Abydos. Rather than flying directly to Luxor from Cairo, as I had originally planned, I now realized that it would be perfectly feasible to go by road and to visit Abydos and a number of other sites along the way. Our driver, Mohammed Walili, was waiting for us in an underground car park just off Tahrir Square. A large, genial, elderly man, he owned a battered white Peugeot taxi, normally to be found standing in the rank outside the Mina House Hotel at Giza. Over the last few years, on our frequent research trips to Cairo, we had struck up a friendship with him, and he now worked with us whenever we were in Egypt. We haggled for some time about the appropriate daily rate for the long return journey to Abydos and Luxor. Many matters had to be taken into account, including the fact that some of the areas we would be passing through had recently been targets of terrorist attacks by Islamic militants. Eventually, we agreed on a price and arranged to set off early the following morning.